Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing. FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. That's right. You'll get up to $500 back in racing credit if your first horse racing bet doesn't win. With FanDuel Sportsbook, you can even watch and bet select races live right in the app. So, bet horse racing on the same app where you bet all your other favorite sports. FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rate plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Yes, indeed. It is John Pollock and Brandon Thurston coming at you on Wednesday, March the 13th. And you are, for our viewers out there, you can see the official Pollock and Thurston uniform has been, we have introduced a new dress code here on Pollock and Thurston. And here we are. How are you, Brandon?
I'm good. How are you? I'm glad you acquiesced to my demand that you also wear a powder blue shirt today.
That was the first message I got this morning said, yes. You know what? I think this should be our new thing going forward. So tune in every week to find out how we color coordinate our attire. But we have a lot to get into on today's show. On the back half, we'll be going over some other news items, including the location for SummerSlam. We will be talking about some ratings notes, Netflix news, lots of stuff that we are going to get into. If you have any questions yourself, you are welcome to submit via Super Chat, and Brandon and I will take time to answer all of your questions. But we are going to be starting off by bringing in Tim Marchman back to the show with us now of Front Office Sports. And Tim, I mean, lost in all of the news this week. Congratulations on your new role at Front Office Sports.
Ah, thank you very much. Yeah, it's really exciting. Good opportunity and platform to dig into sports scandal on.
And if you can just give us just an update from the last time we talked with you and sort of the move from Vice to Front Office Sports and what you've been going through yourself over this past, I would guess, month or so period.
Oh, yeah. So last time I talked to you was with Vice News. I think around that time I was probably talking to Front Office. And I put in my notice at Vice News, and then not too long after that, it was announced the company was getting out of the journalism business. So a lot of my colleagues, you know, lost jobs. There was a big wave of layoffs. I feel very fortunate to be in the position. I got a new job and I'm excited about it. And, what's happening in the media and particularly the digital media industry is really dispiriting. There's a lot of really, really, really great journalists out there who are looking for a spot to land. And I'm just maintaining optimism that hopefully this was Shumpteerian paths and new venues for aggressive journalism going forward, because there's certainly a public appetite for it. There's just a lot of incompetent grifters out there who haven't been willing to move past dead business models.
Well, I think, sadly, I think many people in the space have gone through one, if not more, of these experiences. I mean, myself, a number of years ago, working at a television broadcaster, who one day we showed up at work and we're told, we're no longer doing news or on-air, any new on-air content, and did not let me go. I was like, just left here. And for 6 months, it was pretty much show up at work and figure out what to do and then moving on. So, I mean, unfortunately, this is kind of a reality of news and journalism in the 2020s.
Yeah, it is. And, it's been that way going back a little while. So I am waiting for the, up arrow that usually follows the down arrow, perhaps a dead cat bounce, at least.
Perhaps we can only be so optimistic. But we are here to talk about the story that the three of us put out together this past Monday that you can read up at Front Office Sports, entitled WWE President Nick Khan, COO Brad Blum Revealed as Key Figures in Vince McMahon Sex Trafficking Suit. And I'm going to throw it to you first, Brandon, of sort of just giving people some background on how we, and primarily, I mean, you got the ball rolling on this and how far back this goes in relation to the Janelle Grant lawsuit that was filed back on January 25th.
I mean, in a sense, it goes back to January 25th when we're all reading that complaint and what's in that complaint besides horrific descriptions of sexual assault are four anonymized WWE corporate officers, and they are anonymized as WWE corporate officer number one, number two, number three, and number four. And it was all a mystery and sort of a guessing game for everybody, I think, who read that, to think about who these officers would be. And there's, for most of them, there's some good identifying factors that would really help you narrow it down. I felt like for corporate officer number four, it was pretty clear, probably not to most people who are reading that complaint, but to me that was the former general counsel of WWE who was there at the time. That would be Brian Nurse, not a name that many people would recognize, but it was pretty clear to me that this was the general counsel. It was kind of alluded to at one point in the complaint that he was the general counsel, and he was the general counsel at the time, so it had to be Brian Nurse. And then when it came to corporate officer number one, that person had to be an executive and had to be a member of the board of directors during the relevant time frame, and also had to have an office on the fourth floor. We now know that there are only three people who fit that description, who had an office on the fourth floor, who were an executive, who were a member of the board of directors, and that's Nick Khan, Paul Levesque, and Stephanie McMahon. As it turned out, we confirmed that it was Nick Khan. When it came to corporate officer number two, I had a pretty good sense of, you know, who the employees are, who, you know, the major executives are who work at WWE. But I had was talking to somebody who worked at WWE, and they suggested Brad Blum. And I felt like that fits pretty neatly, especially as somebody who has a reputation of being very close to Vince. We weren't as sure about number three, but number three has to be an executive and a member of the board of directors as well. So anyway, I emailed, trying to find out who this was and trying to confirm, and sent a lot of messages out trying to confirm who this was. And we ended up having a lot of phone calls, for many days in a row and getting pretty close to confirming this. We got it confirmed with someone who would know. And then I think John and I realized, you know, I don't know if we want to publish this. We're very, very confident. We're 100% confident that we are correct, in number one being Nick, in number two being Brad Blum, in number three being Stephanie McMahon, and number four being Brian Nurse, 100% confident. But I don't know if we want to publish this on WrestleNomics.com, non-post wrestling, not much of a legal budget in either of our departments. So we started to make some phone calls out to some other people who have experience in this, just to get some advice and to see if there was any other outlet that might help us publish this story.
And there on the other line was Tim Marchman, who, I'll just state it outright. It's very weird for me that we're kind of dissecting our own work in this sense, but I do feel there is an interest in this kind of thing. But Tim, just on the surface level, when we started talking to you about this, I mean, you seemed incredibly interested in this story. Why did you feel that it was of such news value to pursue this story and, you know, dedicate your own time and resources to?
Because it's plainly newsworthy. It's a subject of intense public interest, and it's one where, in the absence of good information, you need good information. Otherwise, you're going to have bad information and speculation taking over in place of facts. And that's understandable. That's not to blame anyone who's been wondering. I've been wondering who these people are. But to take it from the opposite end, to go from the beginning of the story to the end of the story, I think a lot of the value of reporting this was that we were able to get WWE to make more substantial comment than they've made on the details of the suit to date. I know WWE is not super pleased with the story, as of course they wouldn't be. But from my perspective, if you read the story and you read the denials of specific things, like that a meeting that's mentioned in the suit that Vince McMahon had told Janelle Grant about between corporate officer number one and corporate officer number two and him. If you read the suit without any additional information, that sounds very damning. McMahon is described as saying that he had described the nature of the relationship, that these two corporate officers had expressed questions and concerns about Grant's loyalty and whether she could be trusted, that they were supportive of the relationship between the two of them. You read this and it really sounds bad, and it still does sound bad. But the key additional information we're adding there is that WWE denies this meeting took place. That is important information to know if you're evaluating the credibility of the story. You can take the suit at face value. You can take the denial at face value. You can say, hey, we still need more information to come out. But the more we know about this, the more any kind of speculation or analysis of what seems to have happened here can be based upon what the plaintiff says, and also, you know, what those who are being sued say. The more we know, the better, I say.
Yeah, I thought this was, you know, of great interest to people, of like who these four were. Number one, it eliminates guesswork, which I think is always dangerous territory when that is being left. And mm-hmm. there are people that might be wrongly attached to something of this serious nature. The WWE statement in our story was that WWE takes Ms. Grant's allegations very seriously and has no tolerance for any physical abuse or unwanted physical contact. Neither Nick Khan nor Brad Blum, prior to the lawsuit being filed on January 25th, were aware of any allegation by Ms. Grant that she was the victim of abuse or unwanted physical contact, nor does the complaint allege that either had knowledge of such. And, I mean, it is important to note that none of these four corporate officers are named as defendants in this suit. They are simply listed as four corporate officers, and it's alleged by Janelle Grant that they had some knowledge. They are not being accused of abuse in any situation here, and flat out, they are denying that they had any knowledge of abuse. And this does, I think, give people a clearer picture, because now we do have something on the record from WWE in response to this. We also know who these four corporate officers are, for people to fill in those blanks. And as this suit moves forward, hopefully more is learned, because the natural question everyone is going to be asking is, how much did any of these corporate officers know from the base of an inappropriate relationship that was taking place inside the office with the unquestionable most powerful figure in the company? Just at that baseline of that knowledge, was this something that there should have been red flag, that there should have been some procedure, that this was not a relationship that should have been allowed, given like such a disparity in power, and that it was largely, according to the complaint, this open secret that Janelle Grant was here not because of qualifications, but rather because of a relationship with the person that has unchecked power in this company, in Vince McMahon, that was above any consequence.
Yeah, exactly. That's what people need to be evaluating. And I don't think there's any real dispute at this point that very senior figures in the company knew about or suspected a relationship, and we can start there. The version in the suit is more maximalist. Like, the reason these are key figures in the suit is that the legal theory that Grant's team is propounding is that these people knew about the relationship, should have known that should have known that it involved bad treatment, and that their actions in moving her around the company, having knowledge of it, not doing anything about it, basically enabled and facilitated the alleged conduct from Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis. It's a very complicated legal argument, and you know, it's not my place to make proclamations about it, especially because many of the relevant facts there are still under dispute. But we definitely do have a clearer understanding, I think, of exactly what the suit is saying, and more ways to assess that credibility of the suit's argument. I think it's fair to say that, whether or not it was against corporate policy at the time, or whether or not this and that, I don't think anybody would dispute that the relationship was on its face inappropriate. And so even if you take the most innocuous reading of events, which it's totally fair to take, I'm not saying that in a diminishing way, but if you take the most innocuous possible reading of everything in the suit, you are still looking at something that is not acceptable corporate practice in any corporation of WWE size. And that I don't think TKO, which now owns WWE, would defend or expect to see going forward. So yeah, even at that baseline level, you're looking at tolerance of an inherently inappropriate coercive relationship that is, denotes an awareness of sexual misconduct, and you can add it to the long, long, long list of evidence that WWE was a very messed up place under Vince McMahon. And I think some of the significance of having more out about what the suit is actually alleging and what the pattern of behavior was here is maybe there can be a little bit more of a turn to a conversation about what all this means going forward. This is a point I brought up in other contexts, but I think it's important, as I think pretty much everybody listening to this will be very aware, to think about the fact that WWE was built in its current form by Vince McMahon. He controlled pretty much every aspect of it very minutely. The people who are there, how they think about wrestling, how they think about running this company, all those big things, all the way down to very little things, are all still products of his influence. And people who were profoundly influenced by him in their approach to the wrestling industry will presumably continue running its affairs for a long time to come. And the very structures of the business itself, as well as what the audience is trained to expect, all these things are expressions of McMahon. So when we look at that long pattern of scandals and misconduct and questionable behavior and questionable corporate organization going back, of which this is a part, the question becomes, what do you do about that going forward? It's easy to, it's necessary to examine the past and to get the best possible picture we can of what happened there. But ultimately, it's important, I think, to keep in mind the aims there, which are justice for people who are negatively affected by the behavior of powerful people. And also, what is going to be done to make that a safe environment for people to work in, and to make sure that the company isn't facilitating or enabling or turning a blind eye to any forms of abuse. Those are just important questions. I'm sure there are lots of people in TKO and WWE thinking very hard about those questions today.
And I think one of the important things that we need to emphasize for people who maybe haven't thoroughly read the article or haven't thoroughly read the complaint, but have seen the headlines and are sort of vaguely aware of what this story is about, I think there are a lot of questions from some people about the notion that Nick Khan and Brad Blum may not have been aware of the terrible sexual assaults that I think everyone is familiar with are alleged in the complaint. They may not have been aware of all the terrible, terrible things that are alleged in the complaint that happened to Janelle Grant. But there's no denial from WWE that they weren't aware of a relationship between the CEO of a company and an entry-level employee that he helped get hired. And I think that is a really important point to make. And Nick Khan and Brad Blum are still very involved in the leadership, obviously, of WWE. And I think we just need to emphasize why that is, why an inappropriate relationship between a CEO and an entry-level employee is inappropriate, because it lends itself to the risk of the very kind of relationship that Grant alleges was occurring between herself and Vince.
Right. It's that there's an inherent power imbalance there, and it's most extreme. You can see what's described in the suit, which remains allegations, but are similar to things that have been proven across industries, like well outside the wrestling industry, that when you have this sort of relationship, it leaves the employee with no way out. There's no one they can go to. There's no one they can flag this behavior to, because the entire company is under the control of this very powerful person. And anyone who's seeking to intervene, in the exploitation, or is even refusing to facilitate it, puts their own livelihood at risk, which is, it's a very complicated and unclear aspect of the case, but there's definitely some implication in the suit. I would say past implication of the suit is arguing that it's very likely that's what happened with corporate officer number four, Brian Nurse, is that in some way his declining to fulsomely participate in pretending that this relationship is okay led to his exit from the company in one way or another. There's another point I want to make for people who may not have read the suit or may not have had the patience to read a very carefully written long article about it, which is that there are two sorts of allegations made about the corporate officers in the suit. One involves stuff that Janelle Grant says she saw herself, or, you know, experienced directly talking to people about things, being treated by them in a certain way. But the other, and this is a very lawyerly distinction, but it's an important one to keep in mind, is that a whole class of that conduct, she is not offering firsthand testimony of. She is saying Vince McMahon told her about. The same way, it's pretty notorious now that in the suit, she says that McMahon told her that he showed, explicit photos of her to people who worked within WWE. We don't really know if he did that. There's no independent confirmation of that. We know that she's saying he told her he did that. So
we do have text messages from Brock Lesnar, at least.
Right, another party.
But to the other points, this was information relayed from Vince McMahon to Janelle Grant of supposed actions he had taken, but that we don't have that line that connects that with firsthand interaction Janelle Grant had.
Yeah. So for instance, when in the article we say that the suit basically portrays McMahon portraying to her that Blum and Khan are his key fixers. That's an accurate description of how he described the relationship to her, but it's murkier as to whether that actually happened, and they certainly deny it. So on a certain level, that is the point of the legal process, is to provide a controlled way where competing claims can be brought out, evidence for them can be adduced, and a determination can be made about what actually happened. I think one takeaway I certainly have from this reporting is that we do not have a very good idea of what happened. There are significant disputes over important facts here. And that's not to side with either side, really. Like you can read all the information that's out there, come to your own conclusions about who's more credible, and what the likeliest scenarios were here. But there is just straight up information we don't have. For instance, McMahon told Grant, she says, that he had this meeting with Khan and Blum, that he told them all about the relationship. They say it didn't happen. So there's a question. Is there any kind of independent corroboration of that relationship? Is there a way to get memos or calendar notes or security camera footage that would show them huddling together on a specific day to talk about these things? Those are questions that if the case proceeds and isn't settled, that the plaintiff's lawyers are certainly going to be asking, and they're going to be looking for, and there are mechanisms for them to search for that information through the discovery process. and through the process of deposing people with material knowledge of events.
And just to read that part of the complaint that we're talking about here, McMahon also advised Ms. Grant that one or both of W Corporate Officer Number 1, which is Nick Kahn, and or Number 2, which is Brad Blum, inquired whether Ms. Grant could be trusted and that McMahon offered assurances that Ms. Grant would not do something to hurt WWE. So WWE did give us a comment and told us that neither Nick Kahn nor Brad Blum, they deny that conversation ever took place between the two of them and Vince.
Yeah.
And if you do want to go over to WrestleNomics.com, Brandon has updated the complaint and inserting corporate officers number 1 through 4 for a bit of an easier, well, I was going to say easier read. It's not an easy read, but in terms of just now.
Legibility.
Yeah. And it is only those portions that reference the corporate officers too, if you wish to avoid the rest.
So, Brandon, I'll throw this one out to you first, and Tim, you can chime in as well. When we're like kind of getting out of the weeds of this, I'm trying to look at like some of the bigger picture stuff attached to this. And one that I keep going back to is the incredible power that Vince McMahon had in this company, which was of no surprise to us. We could see, and we have the ability to see it there in SEC filings of how he got back onto the board of directors. This was somebody that had incredible amounts of influence in this company. And then the question becomes, of these four corporate officers, of their acknowledgement, understanding of this inappropriate relationship. Again, if we're going just by the baseline of seeing and having knowledge of an inappropriate relationship, what were the mechanisms and guardrails in place that they could have exercised? Is that too much leeway to give? These are not low-level ranking employees. These are people with very prominent titles, up to and including board members. And here was, I mean, even in these four, that you have this culture of Vince McMahon being able to just have a complete sort of unchecked actions that he could instill in this company. And it kind of does give you an eye into even these four corporate officers being under this power vacuum that Vince McMahon occupied in this company.
I guess there's a question of like, if you're Nick Kahn at that time, the number two executive in the company, is there a responsibility from him to do something about this, to try to intervene, even though it's his boss who's involved in this? And I think that there's a question of like liability too, in terms of like, even if, let's say it's the case that, you know, that there isn't a policy that really prohibits this, then does Nick still have a responsibility to try to avoid, does the company still have liability if they don't protect Janelle Grant, for example, from the assault she alleges occurred? I think those are questions that need to be asked. And
not just like the knowledge of an inappropriate relationship, but one of which this publicly traded company is, you know, she is receiving promotions within this relationship that included going from a $75,000 a year job as an administrative assistant in the legal department to the potential of being a vice president, which had to be reined down to a director role, but still came with a more than 100% increase in her salary on that time as well. So, I mean, there's like fiduciary duty on top of this. And that part is also not being disputed. The fact that she was given this raise and increase in title. And as the complaint outlines, was promised a future VP role had she stayed with the company as well. So, I mean, there's several items there.
Right. I guess the scenario is, let's say Nick Kahn is aware of the relationship and views it as an inappropriate relationship, and what can he do to stop it, I suppose, is a question. Or, you know, should he be willing to lose his job to try to stop this inappropriate relationship, assuming he doesn't know, which they deny knowing anything about any assault that occurred?
Yeah, I think so. There's two points I want to raise there. One is, I think an interesting thing here is just that the structure of WWE as a publicly traded company was so unique in that it was publicly held with McMahon as majority shareholder, but he had completely disproportionate control over voting shares to the point where he's literally able to force himself back into the chair role over the stated objections of board members, some of whom resigned after this. Like, this was violent, vehement opposition, but because of the structure of the company, he didn't just have omnipotent dictatorial power over it in a broad sense. He legally had it through the way the company was set up. Sort of a parallel I've given people is the New York Times, the way it's a publicly publicly held company, but the actual voting stock is basically all held by the Sulzberger family. It can't be taken over from the outside. No one can just buy up all the stock and then control the Times. The real power is vested within the way the corporate structure is set up. And what TKO would say there, I'm pretty sure, is like, yeah, that was an old structure. That company doesn't exist anymore. And the fact that Vince McMahon is now gone with no possibility of coming back, despite his extensive holdings, you know, is evidence of that, and evidence that that really is that specific structural problem with the company is in the past. And that's a totally fair thing to say. It is literally a different company with different people in charge of it. However much Vince's influence lingers in the ways I was talking about before. So that's just one thing for people to keep in mind. The other thing, though, is that I'm really wary of accepting any framing that's like, and I'm certainly not saying either of you guys are doing this, but that's just like, oh, what could anybody have done? Vince controlled the company so much. That's kind of those points about legal responsibilities, ethical responsibilities, fiduciary responsibilities, the obligations that you have and the liabilities that can be imposed on the company or you if you don't do a certain thing. Those are all fair and true and accurate, but it's totally fair for anybody to look at all this and to look at what WWE doesn't dispute high-ranking executives were aware of. And by the way, just because these are the four officers who are named and whose names we now have, that doesn't mean that they were the only people who were aware. The suit certainly says that this was just widespread knowledge within the upper tiers of the company that there was an inappropriate relationship going on here, with Grant being brought to meetings of the executive committee. And you know, the intimation is certainly that everybody would have known who she was and why she was there. It's okay for people to say that's wrong, to say that, you know, maybe Nick Khan or Brad Blum didn't have an obligation under company bylaws to do X, or it might have been difficult to do X, or it might have cost them their job to do X. People can still expect that of them. They can expect that of people in other companies. I'm not singling them out. Like, it's okay to say, I think people should go beyond the bare minimum of expectations for them, or to say, I expect that high up executives at multi-billion dollar companies will do the right thing. Like, that's, you know, it's okay to say that. It's okay to think that of people. It's okay to say, hey, maybe no one did anything illegal here. No one's even saying that they knew about the worst allegations here, but like, this disappoints me. And I think one question that we'll see answered is, you know, what brands and sponsors think. Certainly a big part of TKO's plans for WWE has been making the company more respectable, making it more appealing to blue chip sponsors. You know, everything from starting to put sponsors on the ring mats, so presumably they have lots of plans to monetize their big boom period they're in right now. Does the fact that the whole company kind of stinks to high heaven right now, not just because of this, but because of other things, does that affect things? Or do people pretty much just shrug and say, you know, that was in the past. There's nothing anyone can do about it now. The lawsuit will play out, and you know, WWE going forward can be expected not to be implicated in lawsuits of this kind, so we feel fine about it. I have my own guesses about what's more likely to happen there, but it does remain an open question. And if people are distressed or disappointed or anything like that, they have avenues to make their voices heard. You know, they can stop spending money on this stuff. They can stop watching it. They can write letters to sponsors, like all those things. People are doing all those things. And ultimately, I think that's how the public kind of makes its voice heard in cases like this.
That's what we call around here the Snickers doctrine, which has been recently amended to the Snickers-Slim Jim doctrine, in that, you know, when fans push back about something, well, that's one thing, and that usually doesn't result in actual change. But what has resulted in change is when the Mars company, which was sponsoring WrestleMania, you know, push back against the notion of naming a battle royal after Fabulous Moolah. And when most recently Slim Jim backed out as a sponsor for Royal Rumble, which quickly after that, can't say exactly how much it was related, but conspicuously, right after that, Vince McMahon did resign. So yeah, I really agree that unless business partners really do something, I don't expect change. But I guess like seeing how kind of how people have reacted or how media has reacted to this story, I looked around just before we came on the air here to see what other outlets had picked up this story. And I see the New York Post, Fox Sports Radio, Fox News, Daily Mail, News Nation, Toronto Sun. I assume John had something to do with that, and awful announcing. Those are the only non-wrestling outlets I found. Of course, wrestling outlets will cover something if Vince McMahon breathes, but only a handful of non-wrestling outlets have really picked it up. I don't know if I should have expected this, or if that's sort of normal for a story of this kind, or what. I'm curious your thoughts, Tim.
I think that's pretty normal. Part of the issue here is that the places with the most bandwidth and resources to cover stories like this, they're generally trying to only advance their own original reporting. And that's not remotely a criticism. Let's say like the Wall Street Journal has led on this story. They have broken, you know, a lot of, if not all, the most significant news here. They, I'm sure, are continuing to actively pursue reporting in this case, but their bar is very much going to be about, you know, primarily we want to advance our own independent stuff. Does this advance our understanding of the story so much that we need to treat it as replicate the work that has already been done, you know, by the reporters at front office, and single this out as something of significance? Like, they could, but generally they don't do that. The Times doesn't do that. They're focused on their own enterprise that they're carrying out. And that's fine. I think the other thing here, just from a kind of cynical perspective, is if all the facts in the story remain the same, but Paul Levesque or Stephanie McMahon was corporate officer number one or two, yeah, I think that probably would have got a lot more pickup, and that might have inspired a little reevaluation of things. As is, you know, Nick Khan is famous to wrestling fans, to sports media junkies. He's a very public figure. He's someone who's been on Bill Simmons' podcast and things like that, but he's not a sexy name. Brad Blum's not a sexy name. So I get it. You know, I don't consider it really disappointing. I consider it pretty, I consider it pretty standard. I mean, I've had that happen in kind of other similar cases where I'm covering organizations that have been involved in lawsuits. There's some new news about the suits or information relevant to them. Other outlets that have been covering the suit don't do anything with it. And then when they have new reporting in this area, to go on, they'll do their original story, and then they'll also mention, you know, Vice News broke this story. I'm sure that's what you'll see happen at some point. There's going to be coverage of, there's going to be coverage of the suit that will mention that, you know, who the corporate officers were and how that information came out. So I think my most neutral take there, and I think this is totally fair, is just that this is part of the iterative process of journalism. Like, journalism can be really badly done. It can be frustrating. It can be just people chasing, chasing clicks or audience or whatever. But at its best, it can also be a little bit like the scientific process, and that you have all these different people working on different corners of the story. And the more information is out there, the more the part of the thing they're working on becomes illuminated. And, you know, they give credit to other places and they build on the work other places are doing, just like my own work on pretty much every story I've ever done has, you know, to some extent built on the work other outlets were doing. And you cite that work and you present as complete a picture as you can of what is known about something.
You've been very generous with your time here, Tim. As we start to wind down, just kind of an overall view. I mean, you've worked on a lot of significant stories covering many different businesses and outlets. Is WWE slash TKO unique in certain makeup? And just in terms of, do you see a whole lot of parallels with kind of like other stories of this this type of subject matter, or is WWE kind of in a unique setting on its own?
That's a really good question. I see some definite similarities to other institutions I've covered. Like, you know, I've spent a lot of time covering Operation Underground Railroad, which is an anti-trafficking organization whose founder, Tim Ballard, has been sued by a number of women making allegations of sexual misconduct and or assault against him. And in a similar way to WWE, there was a cult of personality around the place. And I think that's always something that needs to be checked against in any institution. Like, you have a powerful, charismatic founder who has a lot of control over an institution. What guardrails are in place to make sure that they're exercising their power in ways that don't hurt people? So there's a similarity there. There's also a similarity to the NFL in that you have this extraordinarily powerful company that has genuine global reach with its product and is, you know, business partners with every business under the sun, that is also run by a fairly small number of people and is kind of insular. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this from your wrestling coverage over the years, and probably in reporting on the story and the aftermath of it. Is one thing a lot of people I've talked to have mentioned to me is just how small the WWE office has always been historically, that it's like a surprisingly few number of people who worked in that big old headquarters they had in Stanford. So that's another similarity. I think WWE is pretty unique in that I think the wrestling business is pretty unique. There are obviously other kind of cultish businesses, and I just use that descriptively, they have their own folk ways, they have their own ways of engaging with the outside world, and they have this sense that people don't understand who we are or what we do exactly, because wrestling is kind of a magic trick, right? Like, as much as has been exposed about the inner workings of the business over the years and the inner workings of how you make it look like you're killing somebody while you're handling them very safely, there's still a ton that outsiders just don't get about that. And I think that enforces almost a kind of omerta that's maybe not unique in society, because there are lots of subcultures like that. You know, that you can think of, from like burlesque dancers to magicians, to all sorts of different people, but is maybe unique in such a corporate environment. It's one thing to say, hey, fire dancers have their own rituals and ways to mark the person with esoteric knowledge from the person who doesn't have it. And it's true in lots of fields, but I can't really think of too many that are publicly traded on the scale WWE is. And there's just, you know, there's probably kind of an inherent conflict there to some extent, that you have this secretive world whose inner workings always have to be protected from outside scrutiny, at the same time that you're working for a company that definitionally is going to be scrutinized by the public, by regulators, by investors, by all these people. And I think a lot of the weird stuff we've seen over the years from WWE has had to do with that conflict. It's a very outsized version of an old kind of carny traveling roadshow. And it's a very uncomfortable fit with a business on the scale that it is now.
Well, on that note, Tim, both of us want to thank you for jumping on to chat about the article. We could not have got this completed without you. You were just a massive help to us, and getting to work with you was a true pleasure. And I hope that we can continue to work in the future if anything arises.
Yeah, likewise.
I thought when this started, I kind of knew how to write and I kind of knew how to handle stories. And I realized that the ceiling is much higher than I thought it was. So we really appreciate working with you. And I realized I was kind of like an information machine. I gave you guys, you know, this is the story, and you guys really made this possible and reported in the right way. So,
hey, it's a pleasure to work with you guys. I hope your audience appreciates you. I know they do. And I'm just going to be curious to see what you guys do next. If there's an opportunity to work together again, I'd jump at it. And like we were all saying at the beginning of this thing, I think the important thing is just to get accurate info out there and not to, you know, one thing I like about this story is that I don't think it probably fit anyone's priors. Like, I was surprised by elements of it. I was surprised by some of the comment WWE made. It makes me reevaluate what I think about the case and about the lawsuit. And that's good. That's what we want to happen. If all the reporting was just telling you that what you already thought was true was in fact true, there'd be no point to it. So hopefully we just continue learning more and we get closer to what actually happened here.
You can go over to frontofficesports.com and follow along with all of Tim's work. And the man is also on Signal if you want to catch him there and send any sensitive information at timmarchman.01 as well.
Perfect. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
Bye.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, everybody. We have a bunch of super chats here that we are going to get to. And some of these we will answer to the best of our ability. So let us start off, Brandon. Are you ready for some super chats?
I'm ready. I'm going to have to ask for your permission for some of these, but go ahead.
Okay, that's what I'm here for. From Dickie Bird, the proprietor of chop-tees.com. Is there a reason why these corporate officers were anonymized in the original complaint just to have Janelle Grant's lawyer confirm the names later? Unfortunately, that's like a question for the plaintiffs. I mean, we don't know why they were anonymized, but they were. And when we sought confirmation of the names, they were confirmed to us. So, I mean, it would be a question for Ann Callis, and it would just be the two of us speculating, unless you have anything to add to that, Brandon.
No, it's a question that we've had. And we can't really speak to it. Yeah.
Next one up here is from Andrew McDonald. Was there any information on who could have been employees number one and two, or were they harder to find out based on them simply being employees? This one, I will just,
I felt pretty confident that Nick Khan was number one. And then we confirmed with someone who knew that Nick Khan was number one. And then Ann Callis has confirmed that who is Janelle Grant's attorney confirmed that Nick Khan was number one. Like I said, number one could only be because we know the detail about number one being that this is an executive who had an office on the fourth floor and was a member of the board of directors. That can only be three people, Nick, Paul, and Stephanie. And it was more plausible to me that everything that she alleges in that complaint that she's referring to Nick more likely than Paul or Stephanie. Not that either of those didn't have knowledge. She alleges that Stephanie had knowledge. But yeah, number two was harder to figure out. And I had a helpful suggestion that, you know, turned the light bulb on for Brad Blum.
Yeah. And just so there's not confusion here, Brandon's talking about corporate officers, number one and number two. There were anonymized numbered employees in the complaint, which are not identified. So, I mean, we just did not have the confirmation that we were willing to report on employees one and two. So those were named in the complaint as well. Next one is from MJ, who has a generous donation. This is the type of work I've always believed you two should be doing: meaningful reporting in a space full of happy to be there Access Hollywood types. Wrestling media needs adults and leaders. Keep being those figures. Well, thank you, MJ, and have some trust in media as well, MJ. I think that is my response as well to that. Next one from Easy. The number one exec being involved in forces, why WWE itself is also a defendant. It's full of enablers. That is something that isn't talked about nearly enough. I think the power structure is very much discussed in that this was, you know, that is when this complaint was filed, they believed, the plaintiff side, that WWE were defendants here. This is not a civil case against just Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis. And sometimes that fact is lost. They felt the need to refer to four corporate officers, and they did it for their reasoning of believing that this was not just isolated to the actions of Vince McMahon and John Laurinaitis. Now, all people have the right to their to get their side out, whether it is Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, or anybody else. And I will say we aggressively tried to get every side of the story before publishing on Monday so that all sides could have their story represented in their words. So, that's where things land there. And I mean, it's also, I will note, like, it is very tough to report on a case that is ongoing, that, you know, there's a lot of sensitive information. There's a potential trial that can come out of this. All that is possible. And we're trying to report in real time of things that we thought was of value to the public to know about the identities of these four corporate officers, two of which are still with TKO.
Yeah. And I just to reinforce something you probably already just said, John, but it's important to remember that, yes, this is not just a lawsuit about Vince McMahon, which it is, and John Laurinaitis, which it is. And Vince and John Laurinaitis are people who Janelle Grant alleges are involved in these sexual assaults that she says occurred. But WWE as a company is being sued also. And like you said, that is why Grant mentions all of these corporate officers and employees throughout the complaint. And I think that's important to keep in mind. And I'm glad that WWE gave us a comment. There was a press conference, of course, at Royal Rumble with Paul Levesque, and he was not eager to answer any question related to the story. And we've seen a lot of talent actually take questions about this and have said more than I thought Paul Levesque said about it. We saw Shawn Michaels take questions about it, but we hadn't had any sort of official comment from WWE. And now at least there is, and they have denied certain things about this complaint, and they've at least said that they take Janelle Grant's allegations seriously.
One thing, and then we will touch on a few other topics before we wrap up the show. For those that maybe we got into a little bit of it with the discussion with Tim, but I thought you and I could maybe discuss it a bit more thoroughly of just our decision to partner up with Front Office Sports to put this out there. And I mean, it's a part that is frustrating to me in that, as Brandon said, we had no doubt that our information was accurate. And sometimes that is not going to be your only factor that you are putting thought into when putting it forward. We are WrestleNomics and Post Wrestling. We are independent outlets. We do not have parent companies. We do not have lawyers on retainer. We don't have any of those types of protections. And that's an unfortunate part about the current state of media, is that you might have gigantic enterprise outlets that are they necessarily going to be dedicating the resources to something? Maybe they would cover this case in a larger sense once it goes to a trial, once there's a big item. Are they going to dedicate resources to this specific story? Maybe not. And then you have like outlets like us that are able to dedicate our time and the limited resources that we have to this, but also needing the protections to move forward with a story like this and not put our own outlets in jeopardy as well. And that's why a Front Office Sports, they were very intrigued to work with us and be able to help us in that sense. So that was kind of my thinking. I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that.
And to be clear, we got no legal threats or anything like that, but working on this story it became pretty clear to us that we wanted to be indemnified with this story. And this goes to a subject that I've heard a lot of people talk about over the last couple of years about how, you know, well, look, none of the wrestling news reporters broke the original story that the Wall Street Journal reported in June 2022, that there was a letter sent to the board of directors, and that led to the investigation that the board did, et cetera. And one of the reasons why none of the wrestling reporters reported that story, well, for one thing, they probably were never aware of it until Wall Street Journal reported, but one of the reasons why it would be very difficult for them to do so is because I think you need legal backing, and you need to be, you know, with a big outlet. Not only will that make the story reach more people, but you need to have, for one thing, a media lawyer look over your copy to make sure it is written in such a way that it will not expose you legally. And it helps to be indemnified to know that if somebody comes after you, they will defend you, and you don't have to take care of it personally.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think people that have followed us, I think they know that we have, covered quite a lot, that we are willing to, go out and cover. And this was one where it made a whole lot of sense. And to me, working with Tim Marchman was of tremendous, tremendous value to the two of us, that made this story, that much better. The reporting that he contributed. I mean, it was a real great, experience to work with Tim on this.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of the things that we saw him do are like a blueprint about how to handle similar stories that will hopefully inform us to repeat and to continue to report stories. I don't know if we'll be as news-breaking as this, but other stories in the future.
All right, let's chat about just some quick news items here before we wrap things up. Again, if you want to get any other questions in, you're welcome to do so before the end here. Speaking of breaking news, Logan Paul on his own Impulsive podcast. I mean, clearly got multiple sources to confirm to him the location for SummerSlam on Saturday.
First reported by, right?
Yes. I don't know if they gave a hat tip to Fightful, that I believe stated Cleveland was the front runner back in October. But it will be going to Cleveland Browns Stadium. Currently without a corporate overlord on this stadium, on August the 3rd. And yes, a Saturday night pay-per-view. And that means a chance that I'll be going to back-to-back pay-per-views with Money in the Bank.
I was going
to
say, are you going? Because that's not that far from Toronto.
Cleveland is not too... That's a relatively...
This is sort of like Detroit again.
Yeah. So I think there's probably a good chance I will go into this.
I already have a hotel booked. When Fightful... They reported it back in October, but then they also sort of reiterated saying it seems really like, I don't know. Sean reported something to that effect again more recently. And I was like, and a date, I think, was it. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to book a hotel that I can cancel for free on. And if I'm wrong, I'll just cancel it. So I got ahead of the game there, and hopefully I've saved some money on a hotel, but I looked the other day and I actually did not save that much money yet. So hopefully those hotels get more expensive so I can feel better about it.
Yeah. Logan Paul also on his show, I guess, was responding to fan backlash over the new Prime sponsorship, where they will be taking, clearly Prime. They were watching some of their old WCW tapes and looking at that giant logo on the mat and stating, you know what, that a Prime bottle would look great. I personally have, not to say that I care all that much about this deal, but the memes that have come out of taking old significant WWF events and placing the Prime logo, that is unbelievable marketing that Prime is getting out of this. Like the one with the Hell in a Cell 98 with the logo splash there. I mean, I think that stuff is tremendous. Folks, anyone that is pushing back on this, just get ready. I cannot imagine what a WWE ringside area is going to look like 18 months from now. The Prime logo is just the beginning of, they are going to just splatter the mat with as much inventory as they can.
Well, they've got LEDs on the guardrails or whatever you call them now, in the ring aprons. So I don't see why not. And it's the graphic that I put up earlier. I mean, look at the disparity in sponsorship revenue from the UFC, almost $200 million. And you got WWE under $70 million for the last completed year. So there's, maybe there's other factors there, wrestling being wrestling and MMA being MMA, but there's probably a gap that can be closed. Most, you know, and what we're talking about here is unused space on television, like the canvas, turnbuckles, guardrails, ring aprons, you name it.
One is, I do clearly remember this being a complaint that some of the wrestlers had, especially in WCW when they had the big, like, whether it was like a Halloween Havoc logo or on, you know, on their regular television programming, was some of the guys, like, they would literally slip on this thing. Like, it would be very slick. And when you were running across the ring, like, that would be an issue for some talent. So I don't know how much the mat canvas technology has progressed in the years, but that was,
yeah.
I remember being something that would be brought up from time to time. People
I can finally use my wrestling experience to weigh in on this. Yeah. I mean, the canvas is a canvas texture, right? It's a rough texture. And if you're putting something that's completely flat and smooth over that, and that makes it really easy to slip when you're running. Yeah. That I do not want to wrestle on that.
So we will see if that becomes an issue for any of the particular.
It needs to have like grip. It needs to have a grip texture to it so that people don't fall.
So this will be debuting at WrestleMania and will be part of the PLEs only. So this is not a television edition that you will be seeing in the time being. That is wide open for anybody that is out there that looks at this and says, you know what, we could be seeing this in front of millions of people on Monday, Tuesdays, and Friday nights.
Yeah.
All right. Next item here. AEW's big business is tonight at the TD Garden. And are they doing big business tonight at the TD Garden?
As of the latest count, at least as of a couple hours ago when I made this chart, the estimated tickets distributed from WrestleTix is 8,248. So that will be it's probably going to be a little bit higher than that, right? Because we're hours before the show. This is not the final count. There'll be a little bit of walk-up business. Probably not getting much higher than this, right? So it's probably going to be under 9,000, I would think. So
this was Blood and Guts last July that drew that number, as I recall.
Drew what number?
The last time in Boston in July of 2023 was for their Blood and Guts episode. So they're not going to hit 9,700.
Right. So this will be the highest since Grand Slam in September. So this will be the highest, most attended Dynamite in, you know, since the fall. But it'll be among the most highly attended Dynamites in this entire January 1st, 2023 to present timeline that I have on the screen right now. But you know, it will be lower than the first time they went to Seattle back in early 2023, or when they went to Inglewood right after that, or the Boston Blood and Guts, or the Grand Slam. But it'll be higher than almost everything else, I think, since the beginning of 2023.
How would you assess just the strategy of the open secret of Mercedes Moné being on this show, but not aggressively advertising it in-house in advance? Would you be happy with this in terms of, like, Tony Khan seems to really like this strategy?
Yeah.
The CM Punk strategy, right? We'll call it. You know, this, it's a very good number. And I guess you are largely going to be looking at, as well, in concert with this, is what kind of audience they draw tonight. Is enough of your audience tuning in with the expectation Mercedes is going to be there, or has that not been hit hard enough?
When I was in indie wrestling, I would definitely be very against this, because I would tell the promoter, not that, you know, if it was something similar, but for indie wrestling, I would tell the promoter, you know, you're going to have surprise, you didn't draw any money. Big time wrestling is different, where people are on social media actually talking about it. And clearly the Punk thing worked, right? I mean, they sold out the building based on a rumor. They sold a ton of merch. I hope they have a ton of merch ready for this one. Obviously it's going to be smaller than CM Punk, but you know, we'll see what the TV rating is like. If the TV rating is great, you have less of an argument that they should have advertised her in advance. What's great though?
They're coming off a 0.27
success. Yeah.
And that was following the pay-per-view with, you know, a very, very well-received pay-per-view. Did not bump up the number last week. I would say if they are, you know, I don't know what they are up against tonight, but I would, like, this is a number that should be clearing a 0.3. I would
0.30 is the line of success, John Paul says.
Yeah, that is my, they've been promoting this for weeks, and this is it's a big episode. You have a AEW title match on this, and And I guess the question will be strategically, where do you place a Mercedes Moné? Do you ride this out throughout the 2 hours and that's your big culminating moment at the end of the show? Or is, you know, you do, you know, they love to do something big in the first quarter. And then people that have tuned in for Mercedes, they get her in the first 15 minutes and then it trails off after that. I would
want to build Big Bang Theory viewers more predisposed to be Mercedes Moné fans is the question.
Man, the Big Bang Theory / Mercedes Moné, that Venn diagram is yours for the construction, Brandon. I think that's what we want to know.
I would put it at the end. I said the same thing about the Punk debut, but they led right off with it. So I don't know. I would do it towards the end. Yeah. I do have to break some news here that I'm going to do a live as soon as I get the rating, whenever that is. Who knows when that will be. I don't want to make any promises on a timing. I will do a live stream for like, we'll see how long it goes, discussing the TV rating when it comes out.
Okay. That will be coming out Thursday, late
tomorrow,
afternoon.
Yeah. Tomorrow. Yeah. On the WrestleNomics YouTube channel.
A story we did not get a chance to talk about yet, and less so about the fight, but more so the platform that's going to be taking place on July the 20th. 57, soon to be 58-year-old Mike Tyson will be fighting Jake Paul at AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas. And this will be streaming live on Netflix. And that, to me, is the most interesting part of this. It is a whole other debate about if a 58-year-old man should be sanctioned to fight.
Is there an athletic commission that's governing that fight in Texas?
It's in Texas. I mean, if you've got a pulse, I think that they will be allowing Mike Tyson to fight.
Maybe you'll have to have a talk with my friend Ken Paxton about that. Okay.
That might be worth a follow-up. Do invite Mr. Paxton to join us. I would love to chat with him. But yeah, this is Netflix. I guess you can call this their first significant entry into combat sports if you want to divorce professional wrestling from that. And I am sure that this is them, you know, kind of test driving a one-off big celebrity combat sports event. And is this just whetting their appetite for more kind of what would be pay-per-view content, but doing it on Netflix itself? There's no up cost to this beyond your subscription.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see if does that inform their decision about whether to bid strongly on UFC? I don't know that this is similar enough for that.
I think this is going to do a giant audience on Netflix, and I would not think that it's going to be too much of a crossover audience to what would be your average pay-per-view UFC pay-per-view consumer. This is going to be attracting an audience that this might be the one boxing fight they watch all year long.
Yeah. When's the last time Mike Tyson fought professionally?
He fought during the pandemic against Roy Jones Jr. on that first Thriller pay-per-view, and it did an enormous number on pay-per-view. It was like 1.6 million buys. He did win. And
how old is Roy Jones Jr.? Is he older or younger than Mike Tyson?
He's younger than Mike Tyson, but not by much. But it was like that was your kind of like that kicked off this whole celebrity boxing craze. And it's Mike Tyson, and he will garner an audience for this. And the fact that it is just with a Netflix subscription, like I think this is going to be a very, very successful event overall. Yeah.
Jake Paul is 27. Mike Tyson is 57.
Yes.
Who's going to win this fight?
Jake Paul is the sizable favorite at this point.
Is he? Okay. Because he's fared pretty well in some fights, right?
Yes. Yeah. He's only got the one loss to Tommy Fury, which is the most skilled boxer that he has fought at this point. It's
Did
Mike
Logan
Tyson.
Paul's brothers fight Floyd Mayweather? Was that Logan?
Logan fought Floyd Mayweather.
Okay. You see how much I know about this.
Well, it's you're spending your time on much more relevant things. I don't think you have to be feeling left out on this front. Yeah. But it's Mike Tyson. There's going to be the curiosity that can this guy still knock out a Jake Paul that is looked at as, you know, a lower level boxer that is, you know, he's got some skill, but it's at a low level. It's going to be a spectacle, and it's more so interesting for me on the Netflix front of what this represents for them moving forward, what the impact is, and if you can extrapolate this one-off freak show fight to something more sustainable in the boxing or MMA space. And conversely, like as we heard Mark Shapiro talk about, like when they have sat down with all these streamers, they're all asking, when are the premium live events up for grabs? And what kind of an interest Netflix has after they have a year under their belt with WWE Raw, and do they make a big play for the PLEs when they are up in 2026?
Mm-hmm. And can TKO maybe expand into a third combat sport, maybe boxing eventually? I think that's possible.
And the final note here, just ratings notes. Collision on Saturday, second week in a row, it was a taped show doing 427,000 viewers and a 0.13, down 6 and 5% respectively. And then Raw on Monday doing 1,751,000 viewers and a 0.56. So up a bit from the week prior, three-week high for the show. And Canadian number doing 287,000 viewers, which was their highest in Canada since January 22nd. So there you have it. I don't know if you take anything too significant from any of these numbers, but for Raw.
The Raw number was a completely normal number. I want that everybody to publish that headline. Raw rating, normal.
Totally normal. Nothing to see here. Yes. And Memphis, man, I don't know if you saw NXT on Tuesday night. My God, were they aggressively promoting The Rock at the FedEx Forum on Friday night. They are not quite sold out, but they're very close. And they were, the amount of times that that graphic came up for Memphis, I had to have counted like five or six times that they want to keep this sellout streak going. And I think they will achieve it for Friday in Memphis.
Dwayne Johnson is their boss, and if he wants to sell it out, they're going to promote it.
That's it. I mean, maybe we will get Jerry Lawler and Dwayne Johnson together on television on Friday night, potentially. And on that note, anything else?
I don't think so. I think that's all we were planning on covering, right?
What a packed show. So much to get to. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Were you studying our quarter hours?
No, I think we're doing well here though, right?
Good growth throughout.
We have one more super chat. I don't know if you want to cover it, but we've, yes.
You ever hear these people, their show is called Wrestling with the Devil. It's talk like he knows everything about Vince McMahon. I was going to subscribe to it, but after he started asking for your social security number, I'm backed out of it.
Okay. This is Lee Cole, I think we're talking about here. Yes. We are familiar with Lee Cole and his program, where he had a person who seems to be another ring boy a few weeks back.
Yes. Yeah. And we covered that at the time of another ring boy that was coming forward. So, yes. Allison, that was a very generous super chat. We thank you. We are familiar with it. Answering anyway. All right. That's going to wrap things up. Again, you can check out tonight on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. Wei Ting and I will be live right after Big Business. And then Thursday, check out patreon.com/WrestleNomics for the Brandon's Big Business ratings breakdown. Mercedes Monet a draw? If you put that in your title, you are a brave man, because you are opening up the floodgates for such a question to be thrown out to one of the most passionate fan bases out there, the Mercedes Monet backers.
Yeah, they'll get the aggregation. I don't think they'll get it straight from the source. So I'm safe.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. That's it for us. Big thank you to Tim Marchman for joining us, as always. And if you want to go check out our story again, you can go to frontofficesports.com. That wraps it up. Thanks for the super chats. Thanks for tuning in live. That is it for Pollock and Thurston.